So I really want to argue that queer politics are anti-racist and also fat positive. And on top of being about, like, non-normative sexualities and a political identity, I think these are, like, integral to what queer politics are and should be.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 15 of Body Trauma. I just wanted to take a moment to chat with you about this episode coming up with Caleb Luna. If you've not heard of Caleb Luna before, you can find them at Chairbreaker on Instagram. And they're just an amazing person. And I originally found their content through someone else sharing them. And they did a lot of work around disability and fat liberation, body liberation, just accepting and using and appreciating their body, even though their body's fat. And at that point, it was phrased as even though their body's fat, because I was not at a place where I am today, which is still not a place where I'm perfectly in love with my body, but I was definitely further down the journey than I am now. But their work spoke to me on a very deep level, and so when I was writing down people to bring on this podcast, they were immediately on that list. And then, so I'm so glad I got to talk to Caleb. It was a great conversation. Our usual trigger warning will be coming down the line just a second, but I did want to emphasize that in this episode, there is more talk about physical traumatic experiences than there are in our usual episodes, and they're very graphic but very truthful trauma depictions. And if you are thinking about not listening to that because you think it might trigger you, by all means, please skip this episode. That's totally okay. If you feel like you can go ahead and listen, I would love to hear your thoughts on this conversation. We also talk about fatness as a facet of white supremacy. We talk about how Caleb identifies as non-binary and how they define that in relation to how people interact with their body, which was a very interesting perspective I had not heard of before. We also talk about how in Caleb's life, it was their father who was dieting and enforcing weight loss on them, instead of in the traditional story where we hear it's the mother. So that was also very interesting. And we definitely talk about capitalism and fatphobia and how that all goes together. So please welcome Caleb to the podcast. I am so excited to talk to them. Here we go. I want to put a warning that this conversation is not censored and can include potentially triggering material. We also don't censor for cursing, but we will try to bleep out any numbers regarding weight or exercise activity. If at any time you feel yourself triggered or profoundly upset, please stop listening and take care of you and your mental health. That's honestly what's most important. If you're new here, we listen to people tell the story of their bodies. This might include discrimination based on race, gender, size, sexuality, etc., and also the different traumas people have experienced in their body, including mental and physical health, eating disorders, body image, sexual assault, gender dysphoria, and more. Hello, everyone. I have Caleb Luna with me today. It is so great to have you here.
Hey, it's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you identify?
Sure. My name is Caleb Luna. I identify as super fat, queer, non-binary, disabled, and Latinx.
Awesome. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. So what has life been like in your body?
Great question. I like sent you a little bit of a trigger warning beforehand. This podcast feels a little bit timely for me. I've been working on a chapbook. I guess I should have talked more about my work when introducing myself, but
go ahead.
I'm an academic by training, but I also am an artist. And I've been working on a poetry chapbook called Revenge Body that sort of like reflects on the trauma that I have endured at the level of the body. Mm-hmm. And sort of moving through that, which I think speaks to a lot of the questions that you sent over beforehand. So I was like, yeah, I feel prepared to like talk about this. I came from a pretty abusive household in many ways. My father is no longer drinking, but is an alcoholic, and was incredibly violent when he was drinking. I read about in the chapbook. I've been thinking about like my first memories a lot lately, mm-hmm. And sort of the ways that they shaped, you know, the way I moved through the world.
Right.
One of my earliest memories is my dad beating. I don't have the memory of him beating me, but I have a memory of the aftermath. Right. I was like maybe 4 years old, and he used to use this 2x4 on me. And I remember sitting in the bathtub, like unable to move, unable to sit down, and just like so sore and red. He stopped drinking when I was about 8 or 9, and he would take out his anger and frustration on my siblings and I pretty regularly throughout that time. I think that has, I'm realizing more and more how much that experience shaped my body, particularly around my experience in my body, and particularly around men. I feel very, yes. That's also not about my dad. Growing up, I was always fat, I was one of those kids that was like always obviously queer, even when I would deny it, right? I wasn't always fat. I started getting fat in the first grade. So, and that was also a time when my family moved from one part of the Houston suburbs to another part. So I like switched schools. I started a new school. Like our living situation changed. We moved from an apartment to a house. And that's when I started getting fat. And then experiencing bullying growing up through, particularly in middle school and high school. And boys would, part of that bullying was my nipples were like, it was always really cold in school. So my nipples were always very present, and you could like always see them through my clothes, right? And so boys would like walk by, just like walking in the hallway, and like a way to pick on me or bully me was just like, reach out and like pinch my nipple. And one day towards the end of eighth grade, a boy did that as he was getting on the bus. And for whatever reason, this day I was like, I'm gonna stand up for myself. And so I like pushed him. I started like shoving him, and then we got into like a shoving match. And this boy was also like a football player. He was like a straight white, like masculine, like sort mm-hmm. of all American boy, right? Mm-hmm. And so it escalates, and he ends up just like beating me up on the bus.
And no one did anything.
No one intervened. He beat me up, and then I just like sat in my seat, just like crying, and had blood all over my shirt. Knocked out like. He chipped to my two front teeth, and so I remember having like the sort of sandy sediment of my teeth and my mouth. And it was also right, we were still in the school parking lot. Like, things could have happened, but nothing happened. So the bus driver just went on, and I, like, cried the entire way. Luckily, I was, like, one of the first stops. And so I just, like, sat there and cried until we got to my bus stop. And I wrote a poem about that that's in the chat book about it. And I talk about it as the day I learned I wasn't worth being protected, right? The day that, like, he never faced any consequences for that, really. And so, yeah, I definitely still, like, carry with me a strong fear of men. That has, it also didn't really, like, hit me until the past few years where, we were just talking about how I live in Oakland. You're from Oakland.
Yeah.
I'm doing my PhD at UC Berkeley. And so,
oh, sweet.
Yeah. One day, and you know how, like, Berkeley High School is right down the street from UC Berkeley.
Yeah. My friend went there. I did not. My friend went to Berkeley High.
Yeah, it just, that's just another, it's a weird, like, being from Texas, it just feels like a weird, like, I don't know, class and maybe, like, urban thing. I grew up in the suburb, for sure, not near any sort of higher education. But yeah, I remember, like, walking from campus through downtown Berkeley, and all these, like, high school boys were walking by me because, like, they had just gotten out of high school. I remember feeling my body, like, tensing up and, like, preparing for them to, like, bully me, attack me. And I'm about to turn 34. Like, I started this program when I was 30. So I was, like, 15 years out of high school at this point.
Right.
And my body remembered that.
Yes.
And that was such an intense thing to realize that, like, oh, I still feel very unsafe. Around men, around boys, especially. Yeah. I think that's, like, a kind of where I would start with that question of, like, that was the question.
What has life been like in your body?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, like, another, I feel like it's so interesting because I feel like, I mean, there's many, like, aspects that produce my body, including, like, I feel like I'm, you know, naturally a pretty feminine person, but I also have, like, a feminized body. Not just from being fat, but the way that, like, that my fat sits on my body, the fact that I don't really have body hair, which is, like, comes to play a role in, like, sexual communities where, like, in queer male communities, there are certain kinds of eroticized fat embodiments, if you're a bear, right? But being
okay.
Like, there are qualities to being a bear, and you have to have body hair, and that's to sort of, like, offset the feminization of the fatness, right? My body doesn't have that. And yeah, so I thought a lot about, like, the ways that I kind of feel like a target. There was just a few weeks, like, this is in the past 2 or 3 weeks, I was like, I'm also, like, you know, queer, non-binary, femme. I'm a feminine person. I think people think of me as, like, pretty non-threatening, and that also contributes to, like, what feels like being a target. And I was, like, walking, this was a couple of weeks ago, I was taking my dog out for a walk and also, like, pulling the trash cans out to the curb because it was trash day was the next morning, and this man was walking on the sidewalk as I was doing that, and so I, like, put the trash cans out on the curb and then started walking, and I hear behind me, like, a noise, and I turn around, and he had, like, pushed the trash can over into the street.
What?
And he, he said, drop something. And I was like, why does this, like, do people perpetually treat me like they're a high school bully?
Right.
And yeah, so I feel like I'm constantly like dealing with shit like that too, where men try to like assert sort of masculine dominance over me, threatening me, calling me like a fat ass or calling me a faggot, has happened a lot. Which, I mean, I'm both of those things.
Oh gosh.
But like,
I know, but like, it's one thing when you own the word, and it's another thing when someone uses that word against you, because I feel like no matter how much you work on reclaiming a word, if it's used by a certain person, it still hurts.
Exactly. And it's like every time that happens, I'm like, oh, this is why I claim those words.
Right.
But, you know, there's still a part of it that's like, wow, this really sucks and is uncomfortable, and I wish it wasn't happening.
Wow. Like, that is like you said that, and that really is the epitome of like high school bullying. Like, that's what kids in like high school do. And yet I feel like constantly the world is just high school over and over again, just like every 5 years.
I really feel that. I think especially like, I feel like in queer communities too, because like most of us, I don't think got to be like cool in high school or even like out in high school and queer in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I feel like our like adult life is us trying to like, if we can like heal that queer trauma or that high school trauma, in ways that are just interesting.
Yeah, I can agree with that. So you said that you presented as queer even before you knew you were queer. What did that look like?
Well, not before I knew I was queer. I don't know how I knew this, but I knew I was queer like in pre-K. I like remember, and like my older brother is gay, so I'm like, maybe that's how I like,
okay,
had awareness or language around it, but I really don't know. It feels really, especially as I meet other queers who like, you know, talk pretty regularly about like not having that awareness until much later. So it always surprises me when I'm like, how did I know? But yeah, even
I knew some things when I was younger that I can't recall how I knew, but I knew. So I feel you on that.
Yeah, but that's also, like, it's very different from, like, knowing and, like, owning it or, like, being out.
Right.
And, yeah, I think I just because I was, like, pretty feminine, I guess, kind of soft. I don't know. I remember, I'm also, I'm disabled, and what that means for me is that, I mean, I had this injury when I was in middle school, that resulted in my legs being two different lengths, mainly through, like, the way the doctors engaged with me. There were, like, all these, like, unnecessary surgeries and unnecessary treatments, that resulted in that. One of my left leg, like, stopped growing.
Wow.
Yeah, so which also feels like about being like, you know, a working class person of color with a single mother, like the doctor, you know, my mom was an easy person to like take advantage of or be like, your son needs this treatment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and she wasn't in a position really to challenge that because we're so taught that doctors like know best and that they're like objective, and it wasn't until after all this happened where she was like, oh, this doctor was just trying to like get more money basically by performing additional surgeries that were unnecessary.
That's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah. Which is also why I get so frustrated when people like uphold, like, I mean, as a fat person and as a fat activist, like people always invoke health and they always invoke like doctors. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. Actually, like, bleachers are really harmful and, like, have
they
harmed
are.
Me physically. And, like, really, really negatively impacted my health, actually, and they continue to. But it gets, like, pushed onto me as if it's, like, my doing because I'm a fat person.
Right, as if you can just make your legs stop growing.
Right. But I say that to say, so I've had a limp for most of my life now. And when I was in like sixth or seventh grade, maybe there was a girl in my class who, but she asked me if I was crooked and I didn't understand what she meant by that. And I was like, oh, well, like I have this limp. And she was like, no, like, are you gay? Like not straight. And I was like, Oh,
I wouldn't have known that. I'm going to admit that.
And then, of course, I denied it. And I was like, no, of course. Because, yeah, it was, I mean, I grew up in, like, a suburban part of Houston. This was, like, the late 90s, early 2000s. It wasn't, you know, being openly queer would have made my life a lot harder.
Right. So how has race played a role in the trauma of your body?
I think generally, I mean, well, speaking of earliest memories, like one of my other early memories is being threatened by a neo-Nazi when I was like, again, 4 or 5. And this, my sister and I were like walking around the apartment complex we lived in. She was like 8 or 9. And this like teenager, this like white teenager, like threatens us and is like, y'all better leave or I'm gonna kill you.
Oh, and wow.
I didn't really understand what was happening, but I knew that like my sister was really terrified. Right. And so I like followed her and we like ran. And yeah, so that was like the first moment that I had sort of any racial awareness.
Right.
And I think after that, it was a lot of just like comparing myself to white bodies, you know, and like feeling like that was the epitome of beauty. And if I could only like look like a white person, then like everything would be okay or whatever. You know, even talking about like my body hair patterns, like I feel like they're so racialized. I mean, I think body hair is racialized or is part of how our bodies get racialized anyway, but especially for me, my body hair is all like my father's. And we, you know, we're in like non-Black Latinx folks. So we have like we're mestizos and there's like all this like complicated, like all of us have indigenous ancestry in some point, at some way. And like that was definitely present in my family too. And like the specifics aren't there. But there have been other indigenous men that look just like my dad, and have like his body shape, his body hair patterns. Right. And so, and then I look just like my dad. Like I have his body shape, his body hair patterns as well.
Okay.
And so it feels like a connection there of like indigenous men of like the US Southwest, like typically don't have a lot of body hair, either. And so like, especially coming up as like a queer person who like mostly is attracted to men, and then like in queer communities, like the primary location of like people who are attracted to men or people who are attracted to fat people is the bear community. And then when you don't have body hair to like technically be a bear, it feels like for me another sort of racialized beauty standard that's impacted like, you know, my self-image and my self-esteem and like dating prospects and all that, all those ways.
Okay. I didn't know all of that, but that's interesting to know. Yeah. I'm trying to think now. I'm like, I am not the biggest fan of body hair. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. That'd be a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it, like, it's so, because, like, when you're, I think when you're a thin person, there's probably a little bit more leeway, at least, like, in the communities I'm speaking about, and, like, queer male communities. There's probably, like, a little bit more leeway, I assume. I think, I don't know. But it just feels like, in the fact, like, in the bear community, like, if you don't have body hair, then you're a chub, which is, like, a sort of a more a feminized version of the bear, simply because we don't have body hair, and because of that, we have less sexual capital, even in these spaces that are meant to intentionally celebrate fat bodies.
That's so interesting. Like, I feel like, I mean, of course, like, heterosexual communities are very into, like, this is attractive, this isn't attractive, but I feel like there aren't, like, as many, like, nicknames for things. It's just, like, either you're, like, a really thin white girl or you're not. Like, either you got the blonde hair or you don't. Like,
right.
I find that interesting. There's all this terminology that I just did not know.
Yeah, I mean, the gay male community has, I feel like, notoriously, like, categorized every single body type, and placed, you know, different kinds of sexual capital on each. I don't know that the same is true of every other community, except when we talk about, like, race or, like, maybe body size or ability, right? Those are, like, very clearly, like, cut across all communities, but, for gay men, it's just like, you're this or, yeah, there's like 15 different
different kinds.
Yeah.
That's wild. Okay, so what does the word queer mean for you? I know that, like, recently I've heard of the word queer being political, and I was curious what it meant to you.
Yeah, it definitely is political for me. It means more, I mean, it, there's the aspect of it that is, like, non-normative sexuality, right? Meaning, like, I'm definitely, like, I definitely have a queer sexuality, not just in terms of, like, being attracted to people of multiple genders, but in the kinds of sex I like to have. But I also think queer really strongly is, uses sexuality as, like, an entry point to think about normativity and, like, proximity to normativity, including race and gender and all sorts of kinds of power. And so queer for me really is, like, an anti-normative political social position that I think in my work I really strongly try to and also, like, there's this really influential for me essay called Punks, Bulldaggers, and Welfare Queens, The Radical Potential of Queer Politics, by Kathy J. Cohen, who I think is a legal scholar, actually. But it's this essay from 1997, and it argues that there's, like, really generative coalitional possibilities in thinking about non-normative sexuality as just, like, gay men and lesbians, but thinking about all sorts of thinking about, like, normativity more broadly. And so she uses the welfare queen, right, as, like, an example of a kind of non-normative sexuality in terms of being, like, a Black woman, presumably heterosexual, but not necessarily, but more broadly, like, a single mother who relies on welfare, which, of course, is, like, a really misogynist trope employed by Reagan. But, you know, she's like, this is also, even though like ostensibly these people are straight, they aren't necessarily accessing straight privilege because they're single mothers, because they're Black women, right? There are different kinds of normativity at play here. And so she really calls for a coalitional queer identity and politic around more than sex, but then is that is about class and race as well. And for me, body, I mean, as a fat person of color, a non-Black fat person of color, I think that body size is one way that we get racialized as well. A lot of my work thinks about the ways that fatness get, and there's lots of like Black women scholars, especially, who have done work around the ways that what fatness and Blackness does together, right? And specifically, a book that came out last year called Fearing the Black Body, the Racial Origin of Fat Phobia. Have you read it?
I tried to listen to it, and I was like, I gotta read this as a book. And so I bought it for my grandmother, being like, get woke, Graham. And then I was gonna adopt it from her after she finished it, and then COVID hit. So now I can't go over there and take the book. So I'm a little annoyed because I don't want to rebuy it. I'm going to have to rebuy it, obviously, but I was trying to just steal it from her.
Oh my God, I love that. It's so good. I particularly love that story because I'm also like a really big fan of the author Sabrina Strings.
Oh my God, she's amazing. I listened to a podcast with her.
Yeah, she's so great. And she always talks about how her, like, the inspiration for that book came from a question that her grandmother asked, which was, why are white women dying to be thin? And so I love that connection that you bought it for your grandmother.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I think she does a really good job in that book of laying out like the ways that fatness was used as one way to and still like racial hierarchies, that it became like this sort of, through its like association with Black and indigenous people, came to justify like these imagined sort of primitivity. And in contrast, like thinness became a value of white supremacy, and like that white people were imagined as better partially because they were thinner. Or they were presumed to be thinner, and that thinness becomes a white beauty standard. So yeah, I think a lot about like the ways that, and even for people of color who are thin, like that is, I mean, some people, you know, are obviously naturally thin. I think many more take a lot of time and energy and effort into being thin. And for me, it's like, well, you're aspiring to this like white beauty standard, even if you're a person of color, like if you're trying to be thin, like she says in the book, Sabrina String says in the book, like that thinness becomes like a marker of like good racial standing, right? And so even on people of color, it's this way of like, of being closer to whiteness. So I really want to argue that queer politics are anti-racist and also fat positive. And on top of being about like non-normative sexualities and a political identity, I think these are like integral to what queer politics are and should be.
Right. Definitely. Definitely. I think like just so much about body positivity, body acceptance, body liberation, fat positivity, like all of it is just so political, and like it's just been like overtaken by people who are just like, I love my body. And like it's lost and been watered down from like it's just very staunch political roots.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like now it's like, well, yeah, all of us obviously like have our own insecurities because capitalism has produced bodily insecurity so that they can market us like what they call fixes for them, right? Mm-hmm. And so people who otherwise fit like the dominant standard of beauty are like, oh, I'm insecure with my body. Let me be body positive. And that way that will be like me addressing my own insecurities, but not actually trying to like challenge how I think about fatness on a larger scale, not necessarily advocating for fat people and this discrimination that fat people face. And it also like waters down like this movement to how we feel about ourselves, right? Rather than like, why do we feel this way about ourselves? What are the conditions right. that these body, like these feelings towards our bodies? And I think fatness, you know, as part of like my queer politic, I think I try really intentionally to surround myself with people who are really aware and challenge legacies of white supremacy, anti-blackness, colonization, and how they inform our everyday life. But even with those folks, like the way that we think about fatness gets normalized, and they think that like white supremacy, anti-blackness, and colonization has nothing to do with that. Right. And I'm like, no. Actually, it has everything to do with that. It's just like, you know, one of the areas that gets overlooked right now.
Right. I definitely think people get comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I know that in today's world, we have a lot of younger people who are coming out as non-binary or trans. I feel like today we have those words like readily available to the younger generation. So when you were younger, did you know that you were non-binary, and how did that present for you? What was the wording inside your head for that?
That's a great question. No, I didn't. I thought for most of my life, I started identifying as non-binary maybe 5 years ago, five mm-hmm. or 6 years ago. And most of my life, I knew that I wasn't like a traditional man, right? Obviously. And for some years as an adult, as a queer person, I was like, yeah, I'm just trying to like challenge ideas of what a man can be, you know, and like expand those. And my relationship to my gender is a little bit different, I think, than the way I hear other people talk about it. Whereas for me, it's a lot about the way my body gets interacted with, less so about how I feel about myself, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Okay.
Like I spoke about how my body is feminized because of its shape, because of its size, because of the, you know, sort of body hair that I don't have. And I started identifying as non-binary when I realized that, like, especially like when I would go on, you know, the sex apps for men who are seeking men. And I realized like actually a lot of these people, when they are thinking about men and being attracted to men, and what the men that they're attracted to look like, and thus what men look like. Right. I was like, these people aren't actually thinking about me and my body. And so that's when I was kind of like, I'm going to step away from this identity, because it doesn't actually like reflect my experience. And I don't entirely know if I would identify as non-binary if I had a different body. But there was always sort of an awareness that my body was different, not just because of my disability, but because of my size. And there was always sort of like fear and insecurity that I could live up to like what this ideal of men, what of a man was, you know?
Yes. That's really interesting. Thank you for that. So I guess when you were younger, were you constantly trying to like become thin and like lose weight and fit into that ideal?
No, actually, I had like an interesting sort of journey with that where I was like, I've talked about it in the past. Okay, so like I said, my parents got divorced when I was about 9. Then I went to live with my mother. And at that point, it was my mother and my two older sisters. My oldest brother had gone away to college. And so I remember my mom like having insecurity about her size and sort of passing that on to my sisters. And I remember my mom going to Weight Watchers and, you know, trying a few diets here and generally just like knowing that she was fat and that was bad. And when I've talked about this in the past, I've talked about how I sort of escaped some of that critique and surveillance because she thought I was a boy, and there's a bit more leeway,
okay,
with what boys can be. But I've realized more recently that it was actually my father he started getting fat after he stopped drinking, and that made him, you know, go on a series of diets. And so he was actually the one in my life who was weight cycling, who was dieting. He was the one that was more adamantly enforcing like weight loss and these ideas that I shouldn't be fat. And so then I was never like put on a diet necessarily, but it was always like a topic of conversation that like I was fat and that was bad and that was wrong. And they didn't put me on diets, but my dad did things where he would like pick me up and take me to the gym to exercise with him, and we would play racquetball. And I was thinking about this recently because I like exercise. I like exercise in a way that I didn't know I could, that I didn't know was possible, because it had always been presented to me as a punishment, as like the end goal of this is for you to lose weight and this is why you're doing it. It was never like, oh, you enjoy this activity, so let's do it, which is kind of like how I thought about racquetball. Was like, it was really fun. I liked doing it. I wasn't necessarily trying to lose weight. But that was why we were doing it. And I think a lot of fat people have that relationship where exercise becomes this thing that's like compulsory, that's a punishment. And we lose track. There are actually really positive benefits to exercise that aren't about weight loss. But it's taken me a really long time to get there and understand that, like, I like moving my body and I like exercising. And I'm not paying attention to how much I weigh or what I eat, but I am paying attention to what feels good for my body. And that's definitely movement. And movement helps my body be in less pain. It helps me do more, it's something I'm still trying to like incorporate in my life in like a way that isn't pathological. So all that is to say, while there have been moments in my life when the one moment in my life where I was really intentionally trying to lose weight, I was 24, I think. And I dropped out of community college 3 times. And so I had dropped out for my 3rd time. It had been like 4 years. And I decided I wanted to go back to community. I wanted to go back to school. I had been working in retail. And that was, in retrospect, like, also a way for me to, like, stay on my feet and keep moving without, like, having to exercise, you know? But I realized, like, I was like, I want to go to school. I want to be, like, a middle school teacher or high school teacher. But I know how fat people are treated, and so I can't do that as a fat person because these people aren't going to respect me. They're going to pick on me. So I need to lose weight if I want to go back to school to be a teacher. And that was a period of my life where I exercised every day. I lost a lot of weight. And there were other reasons. I also, like, wanted to fit into, like, I wanted, like, easier access to clothes, you know? And then, of course, you know, like, most diet and exercise routines that are centered around weight loss, I got injured, my life got busy, I started going back to school while I was working full time, and I just no longer, like, had the energy. And then I was, like, sick all semester because I was working full time and going to school full time. And I knew that when I was sick, I shouldn't be working out. And then I was just, so I just, like, lost, whatever. You know, and then it took me a long time to go to re-enter the gym space in a way that was about, like, how do I move in a way that feels good for my body and not in a way that is about weight loss. Because that was also a time when I was so much more critical of my body. Like, I had never really, like, looked at my body and been like, oh, I'm really dissatisfied with this and I want to change this and this is how I'm going to do it. But when I started exercising, when I started losing weight, that was when I was like, oh, my body is changing. Like, my butt is starting to look like this. So I'm going to do these things to, like, do it even faster or whatever. You know, I started becoming aware of those things and, like, being critical of my body in a way that didn't, like, actually didn't feel good. It, like, excited me in the moment, but, like, outside of that context, like, is not a way I want to be in a relationship with my body that's, like, super critical and, like, thinks that there are things that
I find it interesting also that you wanted to go back to be a teacher in an environment that was, like, so triggering, like, years later.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's part of, like, there's a poem in my chapbook, Revenge Body, where I talk about all the, like, medical trauma I experienced at the hands of doctors. And I'm like, oh, like, I'm training to be a doctor now. And it's so ironic. And it's so, like, I continue to experience medical discrimination, but because I'm training to be a doctor, I have the language and the tools to push back against it. And also the, like, authority, right? That, like, you know, I'm a light-skinned person, non-Black, not a woman. Like, I have these things on my side when I want to push back on the doctor when they're being fucked up. And, like, for the most part, they've listened to me. They don't, it doesn't always work, and I've definitely, like, experienced bullshit. But I'm very much aware that, like, with my education, with my other privileges, like, I can now enter a doctor's office and typically, like, so far anyway, advocate mostly for myself in a way that is listened to. But I'm also very much aware that I'm training to do this, to become this thing that also caused me a lot of harm.
Definitely. How did you go from just sort of, like, it seems like not hating but also not loving being fat to, like, a place of, like, fat liberation and, like, doing the work that you do and, like, putting your voice out there, being vulnerable, and, like, advocating?
Yeah. I think it started when I realized how much fat phobia is about capitalism and is about, like, making people money. And I was like, well, I'm not gonna, like, hate myself so that other people can get rich. That just didn't feel, like, in alignment with my values. And I also, when I was like maybe 20, probably 23 or 24, I got on Tumblr and was introduced to so many fat activists. And one of those people, or I don't even know actually if you would call her a fat activist, but there was this artist who I followed that I really loved and was really impactful on me, and her name was Mark Aguhar. And she would talk so much about, not so much, but she would talk, she would, you know, her Tumblr username was Call Out Queen, and she would call out like the different, she was a fat, non-binary, trans, queer, Filipinx person. We're racialized differently, but she was also like somebody who I felt like I saw myself in for the first time, you know? And she would talk about the ways that like the fat phobia she experienced, and she would be angry about it. And she was, you know, just name it as unacceptable. And that was so important to me and powerful to me, because it was like, oh, I've been experiencing all these things, but now I know that they're not okay. Now I know that they're acceptable, they're unacceptable. And I know that it's okay to be angry about them, and it's okay to be hurt by them. And she was really, really influential to me. She unfortunately died by suicide in, I think, 2012. And I think her voice was so important to me, and is one that I definitely try to tap into and lean on as a model for like what is necessary, because I know there are younger fat people out there who are still experiencing these things and are still like struggling with these issues.
Well, if you don't even know that the world, like this world exists, like you are just living with those unacceptable microaggressions day in and day out.
Exactly. You know, and there's also like, I think a lot about how much would be different if I knew that there was like, there's a corner of the internet that is for fat people and people who are attracted to fat people, you know? And if, and I didn't know that until I was like already in my late 20s. And I'm like, if I knew that when I was coming out, when I was coming of age, if I had like found, you know, if I had access to the bear community or spaces where fat people were sexy and sexualized instead of being in like mainstream gay spaces and facing, coming out and then like being a fat person of color who was also like a little bit femme was just like its own mind fuck, because I was like, I thought this was like, you know, I thought this was liberation. I thought this is where I was going to be like accepted with arms wide open, and then to like enter a queer community and find out that like we're still replicating white supremacy, fat phobia, ableism, anti-blackness, you know, I was like, oh, this is not the utopia that I think it is. Promised. But I also didn't know that like I could be upset about those things, that I could name those things. And so I think it's important for folks to keep calling that out and pushing that conversation. Because otherwise like we get complicit, or we just like don't know that like we're being fucked up.
Damn. Yep. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the work that you do on social media, and just, I mean, if you want to share about what you do in the quote unquote real world, but how did you come to that, and how has it been influenced by your trauma and your body?
I mean, I think a lot of it was through Mark, honestly, and realizing that she was a model that I needed, and so wanting to be a model for others. I think also part of my history of social media is definitely like needing therapy and not knowing it. Being honest. And so now that I'm like 4 years, you know, I've had my therapist for like almost 4 years. now and I have a little bit better boundaries and more tools and I am a little bit more careful and aware of what I bring to social media instead of just putting it all out there. But I find it so interesting because, like, I think I get complimented for being vulnerable on social media a lot in ways that I don't.
Right, right.
I feel vulnerable to
me. I don't know, like, I probably feel that differently than you, but I can relate to that.
How do you feel that?
Well, people are always like, thanks for being so vulnerable. And I'm like, this is not, like, really looking behind the curtain for me. Like, this is just, like, surface level. Maybe this is vulnerable for you, but, like, also I've been on social media for years, and so this is, like, the norm for me. You're still not getting, like, the deep down fleshy parts of me.
Right, exactly. I'm like, I mean, that's definitely where I am now. I'm like, the stuff that I've shared on social media is stuff that I've already made peace with. It's not stuff that I'm like, that's hurting me necessarily anymore. So even though, like, it might feel vulnerable for people, or it might be something that touches them in a way that feels vulnerable, or that they feel like they can't share in that way, I'm like, oh, I've already, like, kind of, if I'm sharing it on social media, I've, like, already dealt with it.
Or, like, even if I haven't, like, dealt with it, like, it's not, like, I don't share the stuff that, like, terrifies me. Like, the stuff that, like, I'm afraid to share with my therapist. Like, the trauma and, like, what is, like, the details of my trauma. Like, no one knows that. I've never told that to anyone. And, like, that would be, like, being vulnerable for me. Like, that would be, like, flat out just, like, laying on my stomach with someone just, like, angling a knife at me. So, yeah.
Exactly. Like, there's not an awareness that, like, you're not getting everything.
Like, you only know some of me, but people think they know all of me.
Exactly. And I also get really frustrated because, like, part of my activism, which I'm, like, kind of getting over now, but definitely historically, especially on Instagram, has been about, like, sharing a lot of my body, you know, and which really for me is just about being like, I see thin people doing this all the time. I'm going to do this, you know, and then I get these responses that, like, I'm being brave and I'm being vulnerable by, like, posting, you know, I don't know, pictures of me that are like, yeah, like, maybe I'm naked or, like, I'm in a jock strap. But, like, it's nothing that I haven't seen thin people doing, you know, and then, like, yeah, right. But my account gets targeted and, like, these photos get taken down for, like, violating the rules of Instagram when thin people continue to be able to just, like, basically show
whole. You're not wrong.
And, like,
wrong.
It's fine. But you can't even, like, see my fupa. It's so... Yeah, so I think just, like, I think what people think is vulnerable is also informed by, like, how they think of my body. Right?
I know what you're talking about. Like, I don't do it as much now. I'm also like, what if my boss finds my Instagram account one day and then it's like, oh, this is scroll, it's just scroll and Nia's very naked. This is very naked Nia. Like, I don't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. But, like, I know I did share my body a lot, and it was nice to, like, share a picture of my body and then, like, have it explode with likes. But, like, then I was like, how come when I talk about, like, my struggle with food, or I talk about, like, my struggle with fast food, like, or eating or binge eating, like, how come y'all don't care then? It's just, like, when you're seeing my naked body and the words are, like, poetic but not, like, amazing, like, it's me at peace with something, probably. It's not, like, me challenging myself like it is where I'm like, I need to eat this bowl of cereal at 7 o'clock in the morning. Like, why does that only get, like, 200 likes, but my body gets, like, over 1,000 likes?
Yeah, it's so much projection of, like, what people It just really reveals, like, their own feelings about their bodies yes. and their levels of discomfort. And, yeah, and then when you, like, are a fat person who has disordered eating, which I would argue, like, I think mm-hmm. most people probably have disordered eating to some capacity, because whether, I mean, for me, my disordered eating has been shaped by suppressing hunger, because I feel like, why am I hungry again? I just ate, which is also the thing that, like, I realized on the trip back to home is, like, something my mom said. And I was like, oh, this is coming from you. But, like, feeling, like, shame or insecurity about eating in public. And so I'll, like, ignore hunger cues so I don't have to do that. Because I'm, like, afraid of being surveilled. And I think for thin people, it comes a lot in the form of, like, denying hunger cues as well, so that you're not...
Right.
So that you don't get fat. Like, that's... I don't think it's as, like, 1 + 1 = 2 for a lot of people, but I think that many people live that way, under fat phobia. Which, the way I've been talking about fatness is, like, yeah, the stakes of being fat are really high. It's, like, really difficult to be fat. And so I understand why people go through so much trouble to not be fat. But the solution to that is to treat fat people better and treat your body better and let it become fat if it wants to be fat, not to, like, suppress your own eating. But yeah, we can't, like, fat people aren't allowed to talk about our disordered eating habits in public, because then it becomes like, right. Well, this is why you're fat. And it becomes like a pathology or clarity or some sort of excuse or justification. Which I think I was listening to another podcast a few days ago that was talking How to Survive the End of the World with Adrienne Marie Brown and Autumn Brown, which is old, but I'm like just now getting in the podcast. I'm just now understanding like how to use them. So I'm like catching up on all these great podcasts. But this episode from years ago now, I think Adrienne Marie Brown was reading Hunger by Roxane Gay. Yeah. And I think I remember when that book was coming out and so many fat activists were so angry about it and so scared of it and afraid of it, because for them it affirms like all these fat phobic narratives that like fat people are fat because of our trauma. But I'm like, what if that's true? Like, what? That doesn't mean that we are like bad or that being fat is bad. It means that like we have gone through a lot, like serious shit.
And it doesn't mean support. That it's true for everyone. Like your story is still your story. Like Roxane Gay's story doesn't invalidate or change your story.
Exactly. Like if you think every fat person is you're sorely fat wrong. For the same reason, it's because and you made some assumptions about why, like what being fat means. And seeing, like reading Roxane Gay's story helped me understand my own trauma and how that my fatness is in some ways related to my trauma and coping with my trauma in a way that is, I'm like, it feels perfectly
right. Like I know that my fatness is directly related as a coping skill to many traumatic events in my life. But it's just, it's a fact. Yeah. It's not like it makes me bad that like the thing that was like, oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed, I want to die, was like, let me eat a Snickers bar. Like that doesn't mean that I'm bad. That means that that's like what I had as a resource at the time and I wanted to survive.
Exactly. exactly. And it's not thought about as like a really skilled and necessary and intelligent way of coping with extreme trauma.
Right.
It's pathologized instead. And it's like, actually, like, our bodies are brilliant and got us through a lot in the ways that they could. And that's a beautiful thing.
I constantly wonder, though, like the thought if the thin people who are, like, so terrified of being fat actually got fat, if they would make it. Because, like, it is not easy being fat, especially really fat. Like, it is not easy. And, like, it is, like, a day-in, day-out challenge. And I'm just constantly wondering if they would make it.
Yeah. I really don't think so. Especially because I think a lot of, not necessarily thin people, but people who have, like, gym bodies, right? Who, like, have really dedicated a lot of time and energy into producing a particular kind of body. I think so many of them do that out of trauma.
Right.
In a way that is glorified and is seen as, like, noble. I remember there was a Twitter post going around by a person, and it was like a person, a picture of them as like a scrawny teenager and a picture of them now as like a really muscular adult. And it was something, the caption was something like, "Thanks for not texting me back," or some bullshit like
okay.
that.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, you're really holding on to this. Like, you really, like, changed your entire life because somebody didn't text you back. And that's a trauma response.
Right.
But it's not narrated that way. It's narrated as if, like, this person who, in, like, in the same way that I am still shaped by the trauma I experienced as a young person, but their response is seen as, like, noble and valuable.
Right.
Whereas mine is a problem.
Yes.
And it's just so much about, like, being complicit with capitalism, with white supremacy, with assimilation. It's very, very obvious.
Yes. So I want to ask you the question that I ask everyone, which is, in the last week or month, if you want, what has been a high, high, and a low, low moment?
Oh, great question. High, high would be, I actually, I mentioned this a couple times. I'm a grad student now, and I co-authored an essay with my friend Mary Sanyonga about fat activists' response to Lizzo.
Ooh.
And
I would read that.
Hopefully, I'm very excited about it. I feel very proud of it. And it feels, I'm not somebody who always feels proud of work as it's happening or before it comes out. I'm usually, like, very, like, anxious and insecure. Mm-hmm. And then, like, there's usually a process. So for me to be able to feel proud about this while it's happening feels like a huge step. But hopefully that essay will be coming out in the Fat Studies Journal. They're doing a special issue on fat activism that we wrote it for. So getting that in was a high, high. A low, low would be, we kind of already talked about it, but my landlord is kicking me out. And that really is inconvenient and annoying. And I think I'll be okay, but which I feel very grateful for. But is producing, like, a pretty big stress in my life in a way, in a moment that I don't, I mean, nobody needs that stress ever.
No,
but,
no.
In a very stressful moment of a pandemic, looking for housing is a lot. So
definitely. Okay. So can you tell our listeners where they can find information about you, get in touch with you, read your writing, etc.?
Yeah, most of my work now is on Instagram and Twitter. My Instagram is Chairbreaker, at Chairbreaker, spelled like it sounds, C-H-A-I-R-B-R-E-A-K-E-R. And then on Twitter, it's Chairbreaker with an underscore after, because Chairbreaker was taken.
Someone else was breaking chairs before you.
Yeah, and it's one of those annoying, like, accounts that has no posts.
Oh, and has been- yes. There's the friend I never wanted on Twitter, and I'm like, what are you doing? Stop it.
Yeah. Is it another, like, blank account?
I don't know if it's blank, but it's, like, not... It's not productive. They need to go.
So yeah, there's that. I've written for The Body Is Not an Apology, for Everyday Feminism, and on Black Girl Dangerous. I have a poem in the Pantula anthology for queer poets of color. Hopefully I'll have my own chapbook out soon in the next year or so. Yeah, and then I also have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/CalebLuna.
I will put all those links in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
Yes. It has just been so great to talk to you. I'm glad we got to, like, finally, quote unquote, meet and talk about this. It's always amazing in my life to speak with other woke fat people. So I loved it.
Yeah, thank you. Always a pleasure. I'm so grateful and honored that you had me on. So thank you so much.
All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you again to Caleb Luna for coming on the podcast, speaking with me today, and sharing their story with all of you. This week's episode was sponsored by all my patrons at The Friend I Never Wanted. You can join my Patreon for as little as $1 a month and support the podcast too. Also, please go ahead and subscribe to our podcast on your podcast app so you can be notified about our next episodes. If you want to tell us your thoughts about the episode and the podcast in general, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at bodytraumapod@gmail.com. And I would so greatly appreciate it if you would leave a review on iTunes. It really helps us to be seen by more people. As always, I'm Nia Patterson, and this is Body Trauma. See you next time!